From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
At first, it looked like Florida's DOGE efforts would apply just to state government. Now, local governments are also on the examination table.
They claim that we have raised taxes by 80%, which is just as equally absurd.
Also this week, reaction to claims that Florida's alligator Alcatraz leaves a lot to be desired as a lockup.
Look, it's no five-star resort, but we're holding criminals in these locations.
We'll also talk with a school superintendent who believes public education is still getting the short end of the funding stick from state government, and we'll hear some long-awaited good news about efforts to help Florida's coral reefs recover from years of environmental stress. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Governor Ron DeSantis has announced three local governments this week are in the first wave of audits of Florida's DOGE task force. Tristan Wood reports some are applauding the move, while others say it's a political stunt meant to support DeSantis' effort to cut property taxes.
Local governments are already required to submit financial reports annually that are reviewed by the Florida Auditor General. But DeSantis pushed for his own Florida Department of Government Efficiency task force, giving himself auditing oversight. Florida DOGE will be auditing Gainesville, as well as Manatee and Broward counties. DeSantis says the task force will be looking for anything inconsistent with state law, like diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, redundant services, and potential waste and fraud.
But if you're a Floridian, whether it's city or county government, taxpayers should be put first.
The efforts come as the money municipalities have collected from property taxes has increased in recent years due to higher property values. Florida CFO Blaise Ingolia says as property tax collections spike, attention should be given to all local governments.
For me personally, as a fiscal watchdog and as a friend of the taxpayer, it doesn't matter if a county or city is Republican-led or Democrat-led. What matters to me is if you are spending over and above what you should be spending.
Not everyone is convinced of that sentiment. Gainesville City Commissioner Brian Eastman took to social media to argue that the audit of his city is a political attack.
They claim the city budget has increased by $90 million per year, which is completely absurd. That's over half of our entire general fund. They claim that we have raised taxes by 80%, which is just as equally absurd. This sucks, but it really isn't surprising. The state's been coming at Gainesville for years, the entire time I've been in office.
Some groups are standing by the audits. Florida Tax Watch CEO Dominic Calabro says they will bring more accountability.
Cities and counties and even school districts don't have the kind of institutional structural checks and balances that we have at state government.
Ingolia and the governor have used the issue to message support for a ballot initiative next year to reduce property taxes. Those taxes are a significant chunk of local government revenue. Property value increases have led to about a 60% property tax increase in the state. However, that increase is coming mostly from rental and commercial properties, not people's homes. That's due to the state's Save Our Homes program, which caps annual homesteaded property tax increases at 3%. Krajan Mosteller from the Florida Association of Counties says a lot of affordability pains for Floridians don't come from taxes.
When we get feedback from our commissioners, from the feedback they're getting from their citizens, their biggest concerns is property insurance. Property insurance rates are through the roof.
Lawmakers have passed legislative packages in recent years to try to reduce property insurance costs to mixed results. What exactly the ballot initiative to reduce property taxes will look like is still unclear. I'm Tristan Wood.
Is harsh detainee punishment an added layer of the alligator Alcatraz controversy? Well, we get more on that story from WLRN's Tim Padgett.
Since it opened this month, the Florida Migrant Detention Center, known as Alligator Alcatraz, located out in the remote Everglades, has come under intense scrutiny as detainees issue complaints about its controversial living conditions. But WLRN has learned that detainees are also now alleging controversial punishments they receive.
They chained me to the ground. I was in the sunlight from 1 o'clock to like 7 o'clock in the evening. We don't know water.
This alligator Alcatraz detainee is a Nicaraguan migrant seeking asylum. He asked WLRN not to use his name. In a phone call from inside the facility, the detainee, who is black, claimed that over the weekend he had an argument with a guard who he says called him the N-word. He says his hands and feet were then shackled and he was put in a 4x4-foot square in the recreation yard. He says the guards call it the box. He says he was directly in the Everglades sun and heat for several hours with no water.
I don't deserve this. Nobody deserves this because this is inhuman. They treat us like real criminals, like murderers. We just immigrants.
The 21-year-old came to the U.S. in 2023, he says, as a student protester escaping Nicaragua's brutal dictatorship. He has been arrested since then in Broward County, but he has no criminal convictions. Despite his pending asylum application, federal immigration agents detained him last month. He was one of the first people sent to Alligator Alcatraz, and he claims other detainees there have also been punished in the so-called box. Including, he says,
one little friend that I got in the same cage that I'm in. He's from Honduras.
A spokesperson for the Florida Division of Emergency Management, which operates Alligator Alcatraz, called the Nicaraguans' claims false. She insisted, quote, no guards are punishing detainees. Officials are highly trained and follow all federal and state detention protocols. The division also denies complaints about conditions there, like scant access to showers and bursting toilets. Republican Florida House Speaker Daniel Perez of Miami told Local 10 News to remember Alligator Alcatraz is a prison.
I went and I saw this place in person. Look, it's no five-star resort, but we're holding criminals in these locations.
That was originally the pitch about Alligator Alcatraz, that its severe setup was meant for criminal undocumented migrants. But analyses by the Miami Herald and other media show that hundreds of detainees, like the Nicaraguan migrant who alleges the box punishment, do not have criminal records. Meanwhile, the nonprofits Human Rights Watch and Americans for Immigrant Justice just released a report calling migrant detention centers in Florida under the Trump administration, quote, dehumanizing.
Would not wish it on my worst enemy at all.
Janice Mitchell is legislative aide to Democratic Florida State Representative Angie Nixon of Jacksonville. Mitchell visited Alligator Alcatraz last week with Nixon and other legislators. She argues the hastily constructed $450 million tent building structure on an idle Everglades airstrip is a disturbing project.
I've talked to different detainees who are telling me the same story. We have food, you know, that has maggots in it. We have a ceiling that's caved in. When they do get water, it's from the same place that they use the bathroom. It's not a good place.
Mitchell argues it's one thing for President Trump and other immigration enforcement hardliners like Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis to want to detain and deport undocumented migrants.
I get DeSantis and Trump and whomever else decided to do Alligator Alcatraz. These people feel how they feel. Okay, you don't want them here. I get it. But do you have to torture them while you send them to wherever you're going to send them back?
Last week, Democratic lawmakers in Florida and Congress introduced a bill called the No Cages in the Everglades Act that would prevent future immigration detention facilities like Alligator Alcatraz. At the same time, non-criminal detainees' families and friends are pushing for their release. Fort Lauderdale restaurant server LaShanti Gibson spoke by phone with the Nicaraguan detained in Alligator Alcatraz after he claimed he was forced to stand in the hot sun for 6 hours as punishment for arguing with guards.
He just told me that it just felt like he was being tortured, but every day is something new that's disturbing. And like the closer we get to his court date, the harder they get on him.
That court date, to determine if he can at least be transferred out of Alligator Alcatraz, if not freed from deportation entirely, is next Tuesday. I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
Coming up on Capitol Report, state education officials say Florida public school funding is getting a big boost this year. At least one county school superintendent is taking issue with that.
This year, the legislature increased funding per student by just $41, which is 0.7 of 1%.
Florida considers tougher rules when it comes to securing construction sites when a storm is on the way.
No deliveries, no nothing. No one's allowed to put a nail in a 2x4.
After many years of defending Florida's closed primary system, One highly partisan individual is now advocating for an open primary.
So we're having the real conversation of opening up our primaries to the independents and to the NPAs of our state.
And there may finally be a reason to be optimistic about the future of Florida's coral reef colonies.
Being here just feels very surreal, and like, you know, being able to be part of this world first is a really full circle moment for me.
In the latest Deeper Dive with Derek Hamm podcast from the News Service of Florida, Leon County Superintendent of Schools Rocky Hanna joined Dara to pull back the curtain on what he insists is the bullseye on public schools in the Sunshine State.
You're the superintendent of schools in the state's capital county, capital city. Do you feel like, because of that proximity to the Capitol, do you feel like it's incumbent on you to speak up for other administrators around the state?
Not necessarily because of that we're in the Capitol. Just it's just what I do. I mean, I feel like my job, first and foremost, is to protect our children from harm, to protect our children and our employees from harm. But another very critical role, I believe, is me advocating for our traditional public schools to properly fund our public schools and to give us the resources we need to shape the future of the state of Florida, which is our children. And in Leon County, that's over 30,000 kids are going to come back to school on August the 11th. And we need to be positioned and funded to provide those kids a high quality and enriching education. And unfortunately, the legislature over the last several years now has not made funding traditional public schools a priority. And I have been an outspoken critic.
You have been.
Of the voucher program and other things that are diverting money away from our traditional public schools.
And that's why we're here, because we are getting back to school, you know, just a couple weeks away as we're recording this. You know, you also kind of have a unique perspective because you're around these densely populated rural communities. There's been a lot of headlines, not just in Leon, about funding for schools. And I think I'd like you to explain to us, because I was a little confused about this until I was reading one of the stories about what you were saying. Can you talk about the federal funding issues and the state funding issues?
Sure. Why don't we start with the state funding?
So sure.
Our public schools throughout the state of Florida are funded through the Florida Education Finance Program, which presents a level playing field no matter what county or district you live in. It could be in Leon County or in Bay County, Alachua County, Miami-Dade. It's a funding formula set up to ensure that communities and school districts, whether they're in rural communities or suburban areas, are funded equally. Our base student allocation for a student hovers between $8,000 and $9,000 per student across the state. This year, the legislature increased funding per student by just $41, which is 0.7%.
When you add it all up for all the students, it sounds like a big whopping number, though, right?
It's not.
So $41 per student.
Per student, which for us equates to about $1.2 million. But also included in that, $1 million of that has to go towards teacher salary increases in the state.
Okay.
So it's kind of convoluted the way they present their budgets. They try to spin a narrative that says, oh, we're funding traditional public schools at historic levels. But in actuality, they're not, given the cost of inflation and the rising cost of expenses that we're experiencing. So with basically the same amount of revenue, we have expenses that are exceeding $6 million. Our health insurance costs went up by 8%, which is $3.2 million. Our contract with the Leon County Sheriff's Department for deputy sheriffs in our schools went up by $400,000. Our contract with the Leon County Health Department for school nurses went up $400,000. The cost of utilities is going to go up $700,000. So when you add those additional costs, it's over $6 million. You can't have a $6 million additional cost with the same amount of revenue. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to have a budget shortfall. That's on the general side of the ledger. Then we received word several weeks ago that the federal government had frozen a number of entitlement grants that we've had throughout not only the state of Florida, throughout the country for over two decades. Title II, which is all of our teacher development, teacher preparation, beginning teacher programs, beginning mentors for our beginning teachers. That's funded all through Title II that comes from the federal government. Title III, which helps us support students who come from foreign countries who do not speak English, for us to be able to give those ESOL students the supports they need. And then Title IV, Part A, which helps fund gifted education and really enhancing the academic structure and things that we can provide gifted students. And then Title IV, Part B, which is all of our 21st century before and school after programs. All of that was frozen, which was additional, Leon County alone, $6 million. So in total, it's over $12 million that are kind of in flux that we're dealing with going into the 25-26 school year.
That was Leon County Superintendent of Schools Rocky Hanna in an excerpt from the Deeper Dive with Derek Hamm podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. A lot can go wrong on a construction site, and hurricane season can make these sites even more dangerous. WGCU's Emma Rodriguez visited Manhattan Construction Group in Fort Myers to hear how they get ready for storms.
Florida's growing population and rapid development means there's always a construction project happening. But due to our location, we're also one of the hurricane capitals of the world. Dean Ramenet, Manhattan's safety manager for the region, says hurricanes can do more than just damage in-progress buildings.
Not only damage done to a building, damage done to potential projectiles that might leave the job site and hit other neighbors or whatever it is around the neighborhood of what we're building.
Ahead of a hurricane, materials and garbage that can become airborne are secured down or stored at an indoor warehouse. Manhattan's hurricane plan specifically comes in time-based phases. Phase one aims to make clients and employees aware of a projected storm and moving on to phase two with subdued production if landfall may be close to the area. Manhattan takes photos of projects before landfall to reference after the storm when checking for damage. Phase three, about 72 hours before the storm, is when things come to a screeching but necessary halt.
Production stops. Everything, no deliveries, no nothing. No one's allowed to put a nail in a 2x4.
The fourth and final phase, starting 48 hours before landfall, has workers depowering sites, securing projectiles, and going home to prepare with their families. Craig Bryant, vice president of the company's Southwest Florida operations, says employee safety gets priority over project timelines.
We will shut jobs down earlier than some. Just to make sure that folks not only aren't working in unsafe conditions, safely get out of the area if there's a need to evacuate.
Bryant added that every storm has been a learning experience for the company. In the case of Ian, Manhattan, Southwest Florida procured materials from other Manhattan regions. But beyond projects in direct flood zones and maybe a broken window or door, the company's standard for building prevents major damage or delays. Project Superintendent Paul Schmid attests to that.
We primarily do commercial and healthcare projects, so our projects will more tend to be like the one that we are on currently. It's going to withstand pretty much any storm that we're going to get.
Manhattan says most, if not all, construction companies have a plan similar to theirs. I'm Emma Rodriguez in Fort Myers.
Florida's Democratic Party is being battered like never before, and it's not from hurricanes. The state's once dominant party is trailing Republicans by 1 million registered voters, and they haven't won a statewide office since 2018. So what are they doing to stem the tide? WUSF Steve Newborn talks with Democratic Party Chair Nikki Fried. She's proposing expanding the party's reach by opening primaries to independent voters.
So Democrats have outspent Republicans in some races and still lost. So where should you all put your resources? You know, what's the future for the party in Florida?
One of the big things that I think that I have been hearing a lot over the last few years, and especially since the November election, is how the party system is broken. Democrats nationally have a 29% approval rating. And what we have here is a closed primary in Florida. We are only one of 11 states in the nation that do it this way. And the word that I am hearing from everybody you know, that is like, this has got to change, you know, that we are disenfranchising one third of the people of our state. We're seeing a lot of our own coalition base go into the independent lane. We're seeing a lot of people that are just so frustrated with status quo, with system. So we're having the real conversation of opening up our primaries to the independents and to the NPAs of our state. We are soliciting information. We're soliciting responses. For anybody who's listening, we've opened up an email, openprimary@floridadems.org. We're trying to make a decision this year so that we can kind of move the ball forward, because I think that that is what is going to ultimately change how we view politics in the state of Florida, is when we get more people engaged.
Democrats have been rather quiet with everything that's been going on the last few months of the Trump administration. It seems like the loudest voices are on the left. Where are the more moderate voices? And should the Democrats lean into their base and start leaning more populist to the left? Or do you think that maybe a more winning recipe is to appeal to the great middle of voters out there?
Look, here in the state of Florida, we are basically a third, a third, a third. We've got a third of Democrats, third of independents, and a third of Republicans. No party can win this state without appealing to those in the center. And the center is changing. I mean, before, the center used to, you have conventional wisdom that typically people are there, but they kind of lean left, lean right, and there's really a very small percentage that is flippable inside of that independent base. That's changing over time, that you're seeing a lot more of the Democratic base, in theory, going independent. You're seeing a lot more younger generation going independent. You're seeing a lot more Black and brown men registering as independents. So an informed coalition, you got to be talking to the masses. Where is the ability to create a coalition that has a tent that includes, you know, the Democrats and the left-leaning part of our party, but also making sure that we have a message that is going to take 60 to 70% of that independent base, which is how Donna Deegan in Jacksonville and Daniela Levine-Calva down in Miami won, is by creating that type of coalition.
Let's look at the recent legislative session. Floridians are crying out over inflation. Pocketbook issues were not really discussed much. What can the Democratic Party do to get your message out to address the issues that most ordinary Floridians care about?
I'm on a front porch swing, is what we're calling it, where we're crisscrossing the state, going to red and rural areas, talking to Democrats, Republicans, independents, asking them what's on their minds, what are things that are keeping them up at night. And we're seeing and hearing a consistent message. Florida is unaffordable. People can't afford their rent. They can't afford their mortgages. They can't afford their property insurance. They can't afford just everyday cost of living services. And so it's really incumbent upon the Democratic Party, our candidates, our electeds, to be having those conversations. And not just talking about it, but here are the proposals that we are going to do to make your life better. And I think that we have to understand that there is frustration on the ground from everybody, that the system is broken, that how in the world are we electing people time and time again, and our lives are not getting better. And it's going to be the Democrats who are stepping up, having those conversations, and having them everywhere, not just in blue areas. And that's how we're going to build back a party that's truly reflective of the people in our state.
Nikki Fried is the head of the Florida Democratic Party and a former state agriculture commissioner. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Nikki Fried speaking with WUSF Steve Newborn. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, for the first time, internationally crossbred corals have been planted in wild reefs in Florida. WLRN's Sophia Zeran went into the field with researchers from the University of Miami who planted the future of coral reefs in Biscayne Bay.
So I think when people use the term restore, we always have this image of what the reef should look like.
This is Andrew Baker, a professor of marine biology and ecology at the University of Miami Rosenshall School and director of the Coral Reef Futures Lab. Baker just got out of the waters of Biscayne Bay because he just finished planting a hybrid of Alcorn corals from Honduras with corals from Florida. The researchers from his lab and Telemarine in Tela Bay, Honduras, affectionately call them Flondoran coral babies. For Baker and his team,
the future of coral reefs and biodiversity in Florida's waters, and potentially beyond, has just begun.
Restoration these days is much more, has as its goal a way of securing the biodiversity, the species diversity that we have, so that when things get under control, we get the climate crisis under control, and we're better stewards of the marine environment, we will still have all of those pieces left in the jigsaw puzzle of life so that those ecosystems have a chance over the long term of coming back the way they used to be.
For more than 5 years, this team of international researchers has been researching the best ways to restore Florida's coral reefs after mass coral bleaching has caused an overall decline in marine biodiversity. After scouring the Caribbean, they found a breed of coral that has been thriving through extreme heat and pollution in Honduras. Fabrizio Lepis is a PhD student in Baker's Coral Reefs Futures Lab and was part of the research team in Honduras and one of the researchers who planted the new hybrid of coral in Florida. This is him, moments before diving into the water with Baker and their coral.
Having been involved with the collection of them from Tella, and like now seeing this is like, you know, the next step in hopefully what's gonna be a long line of additional, you know, opportunities like this. Like, it's really exciting. It's really exciting to be part of. So.
It's a world first. Of course we're excited.
He talked about how impactful the moment was for him after the planting.
I think when I was coming up with Andrew, I think it really set in how momentous this is. I also didn't, like, I used to be in finance. Being here just feels very surreal, and like, you know, being able to be part of this world first is a really full circle moment for me.
That full circle moment is also so momentous, not just for these researchers, but for the future of marine life and restoration efforts. This is the first time internationally crossbred coral has been planted in wild reefs. Kay Etter is also part of Baker's lab and is one of the many who, although was not on the boat that went out to plant the Flundoran coral, eagerly watched the boat take off.
When I talk about coral to people, one of the biggest words that I use is ecosystem engineer, because they really just physically build the reef and facilitate all these other organisms and species to accumulate and live and thrive and create.
The researchers have been going out about every other day to keep track of the coral babies. Baker did say they are the most monitored corals they've ever monitored, and for good reason. As Lepi said,
they're really precious, so we're trying to protect them at all costs. And we'll be cementing those bases down onto the reef and monitoring them long term.
So far, everything is going swimmingly. According to Baker, the goal is to continue to plant these corals and other crossbreeds to increase marine biodiversity in Florida and other areas like Honduras and throughout the Caribbean, so that coral reefs and ecosystems can continue to survive in ever-changing conditions. And that was it. A boat full of researchers, coral, and cameras documenting the beginnings of a new coral future.
Let's do it. I'm ready with you all.
I'm Sophia Sahran in Miami.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Tim Padgett, Derek Hamm, Emma Rodriguez, Steve Newborn, and Sophia Zaran. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.